Talk given Friday, 22nd September 1972. We may all recall that saying of Eckhart, that man verily is God, God verily is man. Now, Eckhart, as you know, flourished in the 13th century, 14th century, in a very remarkable age, the age which saw St. Thomas Aquinas, it's the age which saw Dante, which saw Tauler, and many other great people, including Moses de Leon, who compiled the Zohar. All this activity was taking place in Western Europe. And it was a time when to make statements of that type, that man verily is God and God verily is man, was a very bold and a dangerous thing to say, because there was the domination by the Church, the Catholic Church, as to what a man may say or not say in such matters. What sort of man had Eckhart in mind when he made that statement, that man verily is God, God verily is man? It's something which needs very deep contemplation, with the mind very, very quiet. And when I say with the mind very, very quiet, I mean essentially with the mind that is free of all its store of preconceptions and assumptions. We all have our own definitions. This is the perfect man. That is such and such a type of man, and so forth and so forth. Now, all these definitions have an extremely limited validity, because the context in which these definitions arise is itself a very limited context. Applied to that limited context, the definition holds good. But here is a statement which has the character of universality about it. Man verily is God. Now, man, we men and women, not only have our own definitions and conceptions of man and different types of men, we also have our conceptions about God. And those conceptions invariably are limited by all our deficiencies, by all our ignorance. In fact, to try to define God is a confession of ignorance. To define God is to try to define the indefinable, because it is the illimitable. It is the unknown to the discursive mind, to all logical propositions, all logical processes, to all sense observations. And all our definitions arise only out of sense observations. But if an Eckhart then said, man verily is God, and God verily is man, there must have been in Eckhart himself some extraordinary liberations from all that restricts man's mind and mental processes. There must have been inward realization of the nature of that which transcends our ordinary experience of man, of the sublime, of the beautiful, the perfect, and all the rest of it. And in the light of that, it was possible for him to make such a tremendous assertion, despite the dangers of persecution and so forth, as a result of making such an assertion. It is true of all real mystics, of all religia who do get free of the shackles of limited personality. It is true of them that universality comes to life through them. The universal manifests and shines freely through the particular. Now this is something we must consider very carefully. The infinite lives through the finite, unhindered, fully. The universal through the particular. And the particular and the finite place no obstruction in the path of the universal and the infinite, the transcendent. Now, if we, as ordinary men and women, look at life and at the world in its wholeness, we see it in terms of the duals of kindness and cruelty, of violence and gentleness, and so forth. In totality, as such, everything is included. However, from our point of view and our limited criteria, however stressful it may be or however easy it may be, everything is included. Now, if the word God is to mean the universal, that which has no beginning, no end, that which has no boundaries, no limitations, and so forth, then it must of necessity include everything that we as limited human beings experience and know and describe. So that all that which to us is conflicting, stressful duality is actually integrated into one great whole in the universal, infinite, transcendent reality. Now, if this remains on the plane of just a logical comprehension, a cold logical comprehension, it will in all probability do harm to human beings and through us, because it is very hard, almost impossible, to avoid callousness to human suffering. And the bulk of human suffering comes through violence, fear, ignorance. These are some of the principal factors involved in it. And in this situation, ignorance, by ignorance I include the absence of this deep, intense sensitivity to each and every creature, to each and every situation and event, and whatsoever there is. I include the absence of that sensitivity in the word ignorance. So now, the aspect of mere intellectual perception does not bring any solution, any resolution of this horrible disharmony which is manifest in violence throughout the world. This other aspect of intense sensitivity has to come in. If you like to use a word which is used all over the world, this complete love which accepts, which takes into oneself everything. And this taking into oneself happens only when oneself is intensely sensitive to everything and everybody. Now this is what we are not. It is not that we do not have the faculty to be sensitive like that. We all have this faculty to be sensitive like that. This heart of love which will absorb everything. But what prevents that sensitivity from functioning is our own preoccupation with ourselves. We are too prone to react to any and every stimulus in the self-centered way. When something unpleasant comes, oh, this hurts. But I don't just say this hurts or this is hurtful. I say it hurts me. And you see the implication there. If it hurts me, I become very conscious of it. But if it hurts the other fellow, I'm not conscious of it. I'm not so sensitive to it. Unless he happens to be some friend of mine or somebody for whom I have some appreciation or whatever it is. You see, we are self-conscious in this very enclosed, limited way, shut up. We are shut within ourselves. What I have always called this isolated self-consciousness which we have. This is where the difficulty arises. Again, when I say this hurts me, I fail to be sensitive, sensitively intelligent of the fact that this is hurtfulness. I particularize it. This particular thing hurts me, the particular person. And in particularizing it, the fact of hurtfulness as a world phenomenon escapes me. If I am sensitive to hurtfulness as a world phenomenon, then the separative selfness does not interfere with my taking everything into myself. And thereby transmutation, transformation can go on. It is because I am self-enclosed that there is no change, no real growth. This is one of the deep meanings of being awake, of being aware. To be awake, to be aware, has been taught by all the great teachers. So many groups of people today in the world, so many societies, they point this out. But we have to penetrate into the real meaning of this wakefulness. And that is not easy, this watchfulness. Don't watch it merely as a separate object, but see things in their qualitative aspect as world phenomena. This is hurtfulness, this is violence. And if oneself becomes sufficiently sensitive to that fact, then violence changes. It disappears out of one's nature. One ceases to be violent. Because when the situation happens to be one in which the stimuli coming to oneself are such as to provoke a reaction of violence, because of this extreme sensitivity, one is awake. And oneself does not react with violence. Instead of violence from oneself, because of that sensitivity, one is only compassionate. Truly compassionate, not just carried away by a sort of an emotional, slushy feeling, you know, oh, poor chap, poor little dog, poor this, poor the other, oh, how awful, and all the rest of it. All that nonsense is out of it. But some other serious, real power, psychical power emerges and takes the form of compassion which heals. And that compassion, first and foremost, heals oneself. Because it is you yourself who are in that beatific state of compassion. And from you emanates this influence, this psychical influence of compassion. Now you see, this is the actual job, the actual task of living the religious life. Merely being awake in this cold, objective way is not enough. If we impose a morality on ourselves through this cold, objective watchfulness, we will say to ourselves, I must not, I ought not. But it is always an I to start with, which is one mistake, and every ought is another mistake. You see, in the living process, things happen. And if the living process is not obstructed, they happen sweetly and beautifully and happily. Always. Look at the way a flower grows, unless there is something which is obstructing it or breaking it down or something. Sweetly, beautifully, happily the thing happens. You see? So the I and the ought being out, then life flowers out naturally. Naturally. Which means divinely. Eckhart said, man verily is God. The theologies have unfortunately, a good many theologies have unfortunately separated God from nature. But I would say, nature verily is God. God verily is nature. The whole, the totality, the completeness is there. Now, if this sensitivity is allowed free play in us and goes out, what is likely to happen with respect to what we call violence and evil in the limited context of human life is concerned? This is a very important point, because we have no means of knowing the consequences of what happens in the pure and the beautiful way within ourselves. But what we can perceive is this, that what happens in any one person's psyche is not restricted to that person. This outward bodily appearance, this solid physical appearance of bones, flesh, blood, all neatly held in within by the skin, is separate from another such manifestation, which is called another man or another woman or whatever, whoever he is or she is. But where the psyche is concerned, whilst we undoubtedly have our own distinctive psyches, the psychical process within the psychophysical organism is not restricted to that organism. It is an influence which affects the world psychical organism. Wars, violence, the precipitation of all the evil things are due to this collective force emanating from individual psyches. And as a collective force, they affect the individual psyche in the harmful way. If we try to see it in terms of, just for the time being, as an opposition of good and evil, then any one psyche is against the world psyche where evil is concerned, and is with the world psyche where good is concerned. If there is evil in my psyche, then the world psyche is going to suffer from me because there is evil in the world psyche, my psyche is going to suffer from it. If there is good in the world psyche, my psyche is benefiting by it. If there is good in my psyche, the world is benefiting by it. Now this, of course, is a process, an activity which is quite immeasurable. We can't measure it. But we have to understand it for ourselves. And that doesn't mean that we have to believe what has been said just now. It's not a question of believing it. It's a question of so clearly understanding it, so fully seeing, yes, of course, this is so, that we have no problem of a conflict within our own psyche, within our own mind. Is this so or is this not so? You see, when a conflicting state like that afflicts us, what happens is that we talk to ourselves in this manner. Now, if this were the truth and the fact, then I ought to act like this, that and the other. But if that were the truth and the fact, then I ought to act in another manner. You see, and both statements are the result of the confused mind, the mind which is ignorant, which is groping. You get it? So we have to see the thing for ourselves. By all means, listen to another's word, read somebody's book. We can't avoid doing all these things. It's impossible to get rid of interaction with all other human beings around us. And even if there isn't a spoken word or the written word, silently, these psychical energies are all the time interacting, and the messages are coming to us and we are sending messages out. So all the time this activity is going on. We can't stop it. Now, if we remain watchful, really sensitively watchful, because we care for this, we can't force ourselves to be watchful. We can't say, I ought to be watchful. The moment I said I ought to be watchful, I've expelled myself from the heavenly society. You see? If we are watchful because we care for this, because we are really religious natured, and religion means something to us, you see, then we will see in this sense. It is this seeing which is the enlightening of the mind. Now, we see one of the very important implications of this. This seeing is not a one act, a single act or a single event, and then, I have seen now forever and ever. It's not the case. I have to see continuously. Why? Because I'm living continuously. And the living being has to see continuously. He has to hear continuously. I'm using the words not merely physically, but psychologically, mentally. We have to see continuously. Consider, for instance, when you and I are walking in the street, we can't sort of take one look at the whole length of Oxford Street and then shut our eyes and try to walk. Something will happen. We have to use our eyes constantly, haven't we? It is precisely like that where this inner life is concerned. This eye of the soul, this eye of the spirit, this divine eye has to be constantly open. You know how they say, the yogi never sleeps. This is one of the meanings of that statement, that the yogi never sleeps. We have to be constantly watchful. And just as when we are walking in a crowded street, we use our eyes and our good sense and avoid all the hazards. Sometimes we brush against somebody or some little thing like that happens, but that's all right. But we get to the end of the journey and we are there. We are safe all the way through. So too, here, inwardly, we have to use our mental eye, our spiritual eye, keep it open all the time and avoid the hazards, which are, these hazards are the evil things of the world. And we will know the evil things of the world if our spiritual eye is open this way, without needing to define it. We all know how the body has its pleasure-pain mechanism inbuilt in the living body. And it tells us, this is all right, this won't harm the body. And the other aspect of the mechanism tells us, oh, this is bad, it'll harm the body. You see? So the body just responds in the sensible, intelligent way and comes to no harm thereby. Therefore, it doesn't have to define every sensation which it receives. It doesn't have to sort of feed it into a computer and then depend upon what the computer answers to say, oh, is this going to be a sensation which will destroy me or which will promote my healthy life? It doesn't have to do that. It's the same with the spiritual eye. You just know. And all the fiddle-faddle of definition is out. But it has to be this sort of intense sensitivity which enables one to be free of the limitation in terms of this isolative, self-conscious I, the ego. This is quite different from fighting against selfishness, from striving to be unselfish, and so forth. Now, apply this to the whole situation which we call violence in life. Violence is a destructive act which expresses hate, revenge, ignorance, stupidity, and all such things. But if I am sensitive to the reality of violence throughout the world as such, in that intense sensitivity, with the eye of the spirit open and seeing it for what it is, you yourself move through life and avoid that hazard of violence. And because oneself moves that way, harmoniously, therefore one is spreading harmony in one's environment as one moves through the situation. I'm putting it in sort of general philosophical terms for consideration. In everyday life, we come up against specific situations and specific actions and so forth which involve the phenomenon of violence. But it is necessary to understand the basic reality, the basic nature of this whole phenomenon, in order to help our watchfulness, our mindfulness, to be effective. Otherwise it isn't effective. Haven't we often and often come across people who say, oh yes, but I've been practicing this mindfulness for the last 20 years, 60 years, and I'm in the same old place, square one. Well, there is no alternative. Go on practicing violence for the next 120 years. What is lacking in the mindfulness is the intensity and the intelligence. This is such and such a phenomenon. Not I am violent or he is violent. But this is the thing in itself. And then there is freedom within oneself. And one can be quiet. Then too, when one sees violence around one hears of violence perpetrated all over the world, one never reacts in terms of violence in one's mind. If one doesn't react in terms of violence within one's own mind, then one is not throwing out psychical the energy which is violence into the psychical atmosphere in the world. One isn't contributing to the world violence. One has ceased to contribute to it. And if violence has ceased inside oneself, then there is harmlessness inside one. For some months I've avoided using my famous old statement, clean out the dirt and the room is clean. Get rid of the dirt and the room is clean. You can't put cleanness into it. If there is violence in my psyche, I can't sprinkle harmlessness in the psyche and say open sesame or something, and lo and behold, I have ceased to be violent. I have to see the violence, and in that seeing, the violence disappears, and the psyche now is harmless. Such a person can contribute in so many practical ways, in the councils of the world and so forth, to bring about the harmless state. It may be that men like U Thant, for instance, had that something about them. What do you think? He seems to me to have been a person who had that something about him. He understood this and did not contribute to the violence in the world. He was an influence for peace in his own way. And Dag Hammarskjöld, he too was another example. I mean, these two just happened to come into my mind in the political sphere, because that does affect the world, affects large masses of people in the world, and so forth. See, this matter is so closely tied up with the question of one's own peace of mind, one's own real happiness. See, we try to chase happiness in various social forms which are not productive of real happiness at all. We are conditioned by our society to do this and do the other and so forth, and oh, we'll all have a happy time, a gay time and so forth. And the result is dust and ashes. Why? Because these contrived ways to try to obtain happiness are more often than not acts of violence upon our own psychophysical constitution. Everybody knows, I don't mean you, but we all have heard of this wonderful phrase, the morning after the night before feeling, which is an ache. And he must be a curious person who associates happiness with aches. You see? Now, why the ache? Because we have done a violence upon the psychophysical organism, haven't we? Now, take that into the psychological sphere, into the sphere of human relationships and so forth. We are all the time committing some sort of violence because of this insensitivity, the contrived ways to produce happiness. Is quite a mistake. Let us not do that which makes us ill, and we are well. That's that. That's our natural state.
And this is one can see in oneself that unhappiness occurs always because of a rejection, because you reject something. Unhappiness, that's rather a, it can be unhappiness, but it's a disturbance. Whenever there is a rejection of that which is at the moment, then one is unhappy, one is disturbed, one is disquieted.
Yes, indeed. Rejection, out of hand rejection, is a violent act.
And yet, how often does one do it in a day?
Yes.
All the time?
Yes, we do. We do. We do it again and again throughout the day. This is why it is so necessary to remain wide awake and sensitive. Then there is not rejection out of hand or blind acceptance, whichever it may be, you see.
No, it isn't an acceptance, it's just...
There has to be understanding. And when the understanding is there, there is poise, there is balance, and there is compassion, the state of compassion. And in that state of compassion, which is only the other aspect of understanding, in that state there is happiness. The real happiness. Although the external event, the actual immediate situation, may be one of pain and difficulty, danger, and all the rest of it. See, the intellect can see this logically, simply because we have fairly well-trained intellects. We have been educated, we can see the logic of the whole thing, and we say, oh yes, of course, that is true. But saying it merely logically, coldly, intellectually, doesn't mean that we have actually seen the truth of the matter so intensely that we are that truth now. The logical, intellectual seeing is seeing at a distance. I am not it. But when this sensitivity is also functioning, then I am that truth. You get Sri Krishna as well as Jesus saying the identical thing, I am the way, the truth, the life. I am the truth.
Isn't it fear that gets between us and the sensitivity? Because there's something in us that is afraid that if we become very sensitive, then we shall get very badly hurt.
That is perfectly true. That fear plays a very important part, a very dominant part in the whole situation. But that's what it is. We can bring in all sorts of particular things like fear and so forth, you see. But if we just see that this watchfulness has to be total, complete, then all these elements which prevent us from being at peace and really happy, they all disappear. Simultaneously. There is no sense in trying to tackle them one by one, because it is not one part of the psyche which is concerned with fear and another part which is concerned with cruelty or hate or delusion or anything. The whole psyche is like that. See, where the body is concerned, we have separate organs for separate purposes. But the psyche, unlike the body, does not have separate organs whose function produces cruelty or gentleness, violence or kindness or whatever it is. It isn't like that. The whole psyche is like that. You can't separate out the parts. So, don't get too concerned with the parts. Use any one part, like violence or fear, whichever you like, or anything else, as the starting point for the total understanding.
If you see one part, you see it all.
You see the whole thing. You see? If you've really freed yourself from, say, fear, you will also have freed yourself from violence and many other things. Many other ill things. Either the psyche is wholly ill or it is wholly well. The whole of it functions that way. Unlike the body can have one organ which is in trouble and the rest of the body is all right. See, this is something which we must be very... We must see this very clearly, because, you know, we say, oh, well, I understand it a little bit, and tomorrow I'll understand it a little more, and next year I shall have fully understood it. That is quite a mistaken notion. Understanding as such is a complete understanding. The acquisition of knowledge is a process in bits. Today you have gained this much knowledge or developed this much skill. Next year you have grown in your knowledge or your skill. That's all right. This is where measurement comes in. But as regards this matter of the mind which has clarity in it or the absence of clarity, that is an instantaneous thing. One has to appreciate that. That is why this way of presenting the spiritual life as steps on the path to enlightenment or liberation or to freedom or whatever it is, it's a mistaken presentation. So we have to be careful about all that. And look, I think we've perhaps talked enough today. Let us spend a few moments now, just very quietly and peacefully, and let the body the whole organism become very, very quiet.